A spoiled child. That's how some Chinese diplomats view their neighbor and ally, North Korea, according to those WikiLeaked cables. The documents also reveal that some Chinese officials would support the North reuniting with the South. Now, there's some debate over how high up in the Chinese hierarchy those sentiments go. And today, the International Criminal Court said it will open an investigation into possible war crimes by North Korea after the shelling of a South Korean island in November and the sinking of a South Korean warship last March. So it's, you know, unsure whether there will be a reunited North and South anytime soon. But what if Kim Jong-il's successor, his son, Kim Jong-un, can't get it together? What if the North fails and the two Koreas do become one? What might that look and feel like? Paul Stairs has studied that question as director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, your reaction to these reports that China isn't, you know, as happy with North Korea as many thought and might back a reunified Korea.
Well, I think you have to be very careful about how you interpret decision-making in Beijing. A lot of people see it as a sort of monolithic entity when, in fact, there are many different interests at play and different groups and generational differences. And so the sentiments that are expressed by one part of the bureaucracy may not be shared by others.
Well, Foreign Policy Journal laid out three scenarios: a bloodless reunification, as we saw in Germany, a violent one, as we saw in Vietnam, and the third, something in between, some armed troops, some diplomacy. But a lot of people are making comparisons to Germany, and especially Vietnam. I've heard people say, for instance, well, how bad would it be? I mean, we fought this horribly bloody war in Vietnam, and, you know, decades later, there are human rights issues, but it's a unified country. What do you think of the comparisons?
Well, first, it's very important when looking at the challenges of unification not to see them in the abstract. Much depends on how unification takes place, over what time period, whether it is a contested process, happens violently, or as a result of state collapse, or even as a result of some kind of political settlement, a consensual political process that brings the two together. Now, the comparison with Vietnam is interesting, but I'm not sure it really applies to the Korean context. If unification takes place violently, then it's probably going to be the South taking over the North, and depending on how that goes, you may face a lot of destroyed infrastructure that could be very expensive to replace. You might face a lingering insurgency, which could be tough to put down. You've had 60-plus years of propaganda and brainwashing, if you will, against the South, and so you could face a very different situation than existed in Vietnam.
And you have, of course, the family dynasty of 60 years, which makes it very different as well. But let's just say, let's jump forward and say the North has fallen. You know, people in North Korea, you know, there's no other way to put it. They're backward. They've been mind controlled. Neighbors spying on neighbors. We read in Barbara Dimmock's terrific book, Nothing to Envy, about, you know, people having to have pictures on the wall of the dear leader that had to be dusted just so, of a North Korean doctor who crossed into the South, and she's stunned to see dogs eating better than she did. So address the issue of the people first, if the North were to fall and there was some sort of reunification.
Well, they would face an immediate shock of finding out about the outside world, and particularly South Korea. They would immediately have to adapt to a totally new existence in which you could say things differently, you could learn about the outside world, you could travel more freely, there may be relatives to visit in the South, and this would be a tremendous psychological shock to those living in the North.
And that would have to be dealt with. Also, that we'd presume that there would be huge refugee populations pouring out of the North into neighboring China, into the South. How does the South view that possibility?
The South views the prospect of refugee flows, and China does too, with a great deal of apprehension. Upwards of a million may decide to leave the North. Obviously, much depends on, again, on how unification takes place. But these would have to be fed, they would have to be resettled, they would have to be assimilated into the workforce or repatriated to the north. And I think most people hope that the situation evolves in a way that they can stay in the north and that doesn't create this tidal wave, if you will, of refugees heading either south or north to into China.
But if they stay in the north, presumably other countries would have to come into the north. What countries would be involved?
Well, again, it depends on the context. If this is as a result of a violent clash and you see the likelihood of South Korean and U.S. forces going north of the 38th parallel, possibly China might enter the fray. And this is a very sensitive issue. It's a very dangerous issue in terms of the possibility of major differences, even potential military clashes between those that are doing the intervening. Now, if it happens as a result of a state collapse and you have the opportunity to plan this and manage this in a relatively organized fashion, then the challenge is not so great. But you still have to feed people, you have to reach them, you have to house them if there's been some damage. They're on the move somewhere, and this is a major, major problem.
That's Paul Stairs of the Council on Foreign Relations looking at what might happen if North and South Korea reunify. His paper on the possibility is at our website, hereandnow.org. And Paul, let's assume that if this change came about, it was because of a collapse in the North. Could you see U.S. troops or aid groups moving into the North?
I think principally international aid organizations and NGO groups that would go first, assuming again that they were being welcomed to do this. This, however, may require some South Korean forces to go in there to provide some security to food deliveries. Remember, you could be in a situation of widespread lawlessness and you would have to protect the food supplies and prevent looting and things like this, as we saw after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And what's particularly corrosive is if public security breaks down and then that affects the legitimacy of the government and you get people who wanting to change the political situation and so on. And it suddenly pivots into a much more complex and dangerous situation if it's not handled properly.
Japan, I would think, would be on tenderhooks here because of its history of brutal occupation before World War II and before the peninsula was divided. They would have to be careful not to appear to be an occupier again.
Yes, I don't see that Japan would play an active role in providing any of the relief supplies or humanitarian assistance, not in the sense of actually delivering it on the ground. I think there would be great resistance to the idea of the Japanese playing a role. They may, however, face their own refugee problem in which North Koreans take to boats and try to cross the Sea of Japan to reach Japan. I think they would help obviously provide some food through South Korea and maybe medical supplies as well.
Well, you write that with a population of 23 million in the north, about 115 to 230,000 military troops would be needed to help keep the peace if the north fell. But what about the North Korean military? And of course, the big question, the weapons that North Korea does have.
Yeah, there are a whole host of security issues that would need to be met here. One is obviously the disposition of the nuclear weapon stockpiles that the North Koreans are believed to have, as well as chemical weapons, even biological weapons. And the immediate imperative would be to secure those, to prevent any kind of leakage, to secure the personnel and scientists associated with that program, again, to prevent any kind of proliferation risk.
And you say here you can learn again from Iraq by not getting rid of all the scientists and the experts and maybe in trying to involve them.
Yes, I think one of the lessons of the Iraq experience is that you need to seek the cooperation of those working in the nuclear weapons program to find out where stocks are being held and safeguarded and to try to get more information on key personnel in the programs, again, to prevent them from either leaving the country or selling their expertise on the black market. The other big question mark is the North Korean conventional forces, and particularly the special forces. You know, would they be cooperative? Would this be a what the military calls a permissive environment in which they would essentially support any kind of intervention, or would they oppose it and it become a non-permissive environment? You mentioned the figure of between 100 and 230,000 forces. That's for a permissive environment. if there is an active insurgency or resistance by the North Korean military, that figure rises dramatically to over 400,000, and some would say even higher numbers. Where are those forces going to come from? That's a huge amount of forces that would be required, well beyond the capacity of just South Korea and the US. So you may need help from the international community and others to really provide order to the North if this is a more lawless environment.
Well, Paul Stairs, we haven't even touched on how a unified Korea might go forward, given that, you know, you'd have to create a new economy. And in the North, we're not even sure, you know, who owns land, for instance, which is one of the reasons that people are suggesting that the South might want to keep the North as a sort of a separate entity. But I'm just wondering, with all the criticism about North Korea, do world actors actually maybe think it's better to keep the North and the South separate and the North contained?
Well, no one wants to face the challenges of unification at this time. Everybody recognizes it would be hugely challenging and it'd be immensely expensive. It cost Germany over $2 trillion over two decades, and many people think the price tag would be much higher for Korea because North Korea is a much sort of lower level of development than East Germany was. So people want to try to manage this process, to possibly prolong the process, make it as cooperative and consensual as possible, which has led some people to think, well, instead of a kind of Big Bang type unification, let's play this out. Maybe have a sort of one Korea, two systems approach or confederated approach in which North Korea is part of a larger united Korea, but it's a slower process of assimilation and unification rather than something that's very rapid and very costly.
Well, it's all just speculation anyway, I should say, for people who have just tuned in. Is there a speculation about when?
We say not now. We may not have a choice. This may happen sooner rather than later. It may happen if there's a sudden change in power in Pyongyang, in which the current leader, Kim Jong-il, dies suddenly and the mantle is handed off to his third son, Kim Jong-un. And he may face all kinds of challenges from within. His legitimacy as the leader may not be accepted, and that could lead to civil conflict in the North and collapse and so on. And so it may happen sooner than we anticipate and sooner than we might hope.
That's Paul Stairs, director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been sort of musing about what a reunified Korean Peninsula might look and feel like. Paul, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.